On this 16th day of March 2011, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th Kela, chapter 18, text description of Varnashram Dharma, text 37. Nahi tasya vikalpakya yachaman vikshayahata adehan tat kuchit kyatis tatak sampadyate maya. Translation. A realized soul no longer sees anything as separate from me, for his realized knowledge of me has destroyed such illusory perception. Since the material body and mind were previously accustomed to this kind of perception, it may sometimes appear to reoccur. But at the time of death, the self-realized soul achieves opulences equal to mine. Purport. Lord Krishna explained in verse 32 of this chapter that all material and spiritual objects are expansions of his potency. By realized knowledge of the Lord, one gives up the illusion that anything, anywhere, at any time, can be separate from Lord Krishna. Lord Krishna has also explained, however, that one must keep the material body and mind fit for executing devotional service. Therefore, even a self-realized soul may sometimes appear to accept or reject certain conditions or objects within this world. Such brief apparent duality of concentration upon something other than Krishna does not change the liberated status of a self-realized soul, who achieves at the time of death the same opulences as Lord Krishna in the spiritual world. The function of illusion is to separate one from Lord Krishna. But the brief and occasional appearance of duality in the behavior or mentality of a pure devotee never separates him from the Lord. It does not constitute actual illusion, for it lacks the essential function of illusion, namely, the separation of one from Lord Krishna. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur describes the self-realized devotees as follows. The devotee of the Lord does not see anything as separate from Lord Krishna, and thus does not consider himself to be a permanent resident of the material world. At every moment, the devotee is moved by his desire to serve Lord Krishna. Just as those who are inclined to sense gratification pass their time making arrangements for their enjoyment, similarly, the devotees are busy throughout the day arranging their devotional service to Lord Krishna. Therefore, they have no time to act like materialistic sense enjoyers. To ordinary persons, it may seem that a pure devotee is seeing something as separate from Krishna, but a pure devotee is actually fixed in his status as a liberated soul and is guaranteed to achieve a spiritual body in the kingdom of God. Ordinary materialistic persons cannot always understand the activities of a pure devotee of the Lord, and thus they may try to minimize his position, considering him to be the same as themselves. At the end of life, however, the results achieved by the devotees of the Lord and ordinary materialists are vastly different. Oma jnana timarandasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshur unmiratam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, second chapter, first canto, the absolute truth has been defined, this Brahman, this idea of Brahman. Brahman, the word simply means the great, the infinite, the all-encompassing. So this Brahman, it is said, vadanti tat-tat-pravidas, tatvam yajnanam advayam, brahmeti paramatmeti bhagaman iti shabdite. So it is said there that the knowers of the truth have said, he's citing, Sutta Goswami is citing the tattva vidha, those who know the tattva, the truth of this Brahman that we're supposed to inquire into, this absolute truth as human beings. So they say, they declare, that it's non-dual knowledge or pure consciousness, but it's realized in different ways as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So in one sense, they're all Brahman. And Krishna is known as Parabrahman as well. But there's a distinction. So Brahman here means the undifferentiated effulgence of the Lord, what we call the Brahma Jyoti or Brahma Jyotir. No varieties, simply pure consciousness, pure spirit, which is effulgent. So, which is understood to be the effulgence of Krishna's body. But there are those who reject the varieties in the spiritual life, and they want to merge into this Brahman. They want to realize the Supreme in that aspect. They're averse to service of the Lord. So by great effort, they may realize this. So that's one understanding, Brahman. And then there's Paramatma, which is the super soul in the heart. So there's localized in your heart, each of our hearts, there's a super soul in the atom, you see. So that's said to be individual. And he takes a form. It's a form of the super soul as Vishnu, with the four arms like that, sitting there. So that's a higher realization. And it's realized by the yogis. The other one is realized by the gyanis, or those who cultivate spiritual knowledge, separating matter from spirit. The yogis can realize this super soul within the heart by deep meditation. And then there's Bhagavan. Bhagavan means the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has activities, pastimes, what we call pastimes, personality qualities, a world, activities, friends, everything. So that's the most complete understanding of this absolute truth, what we call the absolute truth. So, but still, we should understand all three, and that there's a certain oneness to everything. And that oneness can be understood as everything is Krishna, in the sense that everything is His energies or His direct expansions. There's nothing else in existence but those two things. Now, we are also part of that energy. We are said to be the marginal energy or the tatastha shakti. It's interesting. This is a very instructive term. Think of it this way. There's God in His kingdom, and He manifests that kingdom. How? Through His energies and through His direct expansions. So there's a distinction there. So first the energies, there's the existence energy, which manifests all the things there. You know, when we think of the spiritual world, we see a painting, we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam or another scripture, there's a description there. There are trees there, there's land, there's nice rivers, there's Goloka Vrindavan, you know. The cows are there. There's so many things, just like we have here. If you walk outside, you can start to describe what you see. So similarly, there are things there. That's all part of Krishna's energy. But it's a different kind of energy than manifests this world. It's called the Sandini Shakti. It's pure spiritual, purely spirit. Everything is conscious, all these energies. The land is conscious. The trees are fully conscious. In Goloka, in the kingdom of God. So then there's so that's the existence energy. Then there's the knowledge energy. Now all the living beings, they know of Krishna and they know of His Leela. And so that's another energy that is important. And then there's the bliss energy called Ladini Shakti, by which all the living beings there, different forms, experience happiness by serving the Krishna. You see? So you have these three, existence and knowledge and bliss. Now it's just like Satchitananda, right? Satchitananda. Sat is existence, chit is consciousness or knowledge, and ananda is bliss. So that's the energies that manifest that. That existence, knowledge, and bliss in the spiritual world. And then, so that's the spiritual energies. Then there are the material energies. Described very nicely in Bhagavad Gita in summary. Bhumar, Apo, Onanovaya. This is 7th chapter, 3rd verse, 4th verse, I believe. So, earth, you know, when you say earth, we mean solid matter. You know, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, like we see the electricity, fire, like that. Even the fire in your stomach that digests things is said to be part of this fiery energy of Krishna. Space. So you have earth, water, fire, air, you know, gases. Ether, the space is also a material energy. And then the more subtle, the mind. This is also material. The mind we have is this mind stuff. Intelligence, discrimination, that's another energy. Very subtle energy of Krishna. And finally, the ego. So you have these eight material energies. These are said to be by Krishna the apara prakriti, or the lower energy. You see, the unconscious, dead energy. It's not conscious. So Krishna, and it's separated from him, and they're separated from each other. So you have, but then there's a higher energy. He says, apare amitastranyam prakritim vidnime param. So he said, these are the lower, apara, not transcendental. But there's a transcendental energy, right? Prakriti vidnime, you should understand, there's another prakriti, or energy. And what is that? Jiva bhutam, mahabhao yeyidam dayate. The jivas, we ourselves, are a different category of energy than these eight. And we sustain, we're sustaining this universe. This little, these bodies of ours are little mini universes. You know, we're sustaining. When the living entity leaves at death, the body is no longer sustained. It becomes dust, it's burned, buried, whatever. It's no longer a body. It's just just chemicals. So these are the three general categories of energy. The internal energy with those three divisions that I mentioned, right? Existence, knowledge, bliss. And the external energy with those eight divisions I mentioned. And then there's the marginal energy, the intermediate energy, which is, by nature, we're transcendental. But because we're so minute, we have a tendency to get covered over by this external energy. Now, these eight energies I mentioned, they interact by the force of the modes, what we call the modes of nature. It gets a little complicated. But I want to get back to this verse. So the idea is that all of these are Krishna's energies. Now, why are we called marginal? We're called marginal because we're just like this part of the beach. You go down to the ocean. Go down to the ocean shore, the actual point where the sea comes in. And you'll see the sea's coming in, going out, coming in, going out. So there's a portion there that's sometimes covered and sometimes not, right? Now, when the tide comes in, that may move up the beach a little bit, but there's always some portion that's covered and uncovered, covered and uncovered. So that's us. That's where we're marginal, which means that we can be covered, but we can also be uncovered. Now, we have free will. We can decide which category of energy is influencing us. Right now, due to our decision we made many eons ago, previous births, we're being influenced by this lower energy, by the external energy. And we're identifying ourselves, who are by nature transcendental, with this material body. And not only the material body, but the things related to it. You're born in a certain country, and you're raised up. When you're a little baby, you don't know anything. All you know is you're hungry, and there's the breast. You know, my body and my mother's body, right? And that's your whole life. But as you grow older, your consciousness expands. You learn, oh, you know, that I have other senses. You know, when you see little kids, they discover their senses. And it's not just, you know, I always like to see when the kids learn to walk, and shortly after they learn to run. And it's a whole different ball game. They have a whole different field of activity, right? And the mother has to spend a lot more time watching where they are, what they're doing, right? So that's a sense. The feet are a sense, too. They're an active sense. So the kids, they just discover this whole field of activity. Oh, there's so many things to see and hear, right? That's what it is. They're little balls of sensory perception. So that's, and they completely identify. And they say, okay, I'm this little child, and I'm, you know, related to this mother and this father and like that, you know. And as you grow up, oh, I have a circle of friends, and I realize I'm, you know, learning to speak, and they speak a certain language, a certain nation, you know, and you learn the history. Oh, I see, I'm a Croatian, you know. Oh, no, I'm a Japanese, you know, or a Chinese, you know, and whatever. So you identify yourself with the body and its extensions and its relations. And this is all illusory, because we're spirit. You know, we're temporarily in this particular body for, what, 70, 80, 90 years most, you know. Then you're in a whole other body, maybe a human body. So what happens to your, you know, American designation? You know, oh, I'm California, I'm a valley girl, whatever. You know? What happens to that? Well, you grow out of that even in this body, but the point is, you know, it keeps changing. And then you lose a body. And you're in a whole other body. You grow up and you know, oh, now I'm you know, Mongolian or something, you know, and you identify with that. So that illusion is the first thing we have to break. And that's the first lesson of Bhagavad Gita. You're not this body. So the marginal potency, we ourselves, the whole process of Krishna consciousness is changing our focus. away from this body and its senses and its sensory perceptions and its material relations, and identifying ourselves differently. First having it, understanding our real ego, and then acting on that basis, and gradually developing a consciousness of ourselves as spirit souls, and more than that, as servants of Krishna. And that's a designation. It's not a material designation. That's our real designation, or swarup. That's our real nature. Now, back to our verse. So a realized soul doesn't see anything separate from me. So you see, constantly aware of this idea. Oh, this is Krishna's energy working. This is Krishna's energy. Just like Prabhupada gives the example of the mother goes into the child's room, and the child has just grown out of his little baby shoes, and he has other shoes, and he's gone off to kindergarten, say, you know. But there are the little baby shoes they have when they're like, you know, what, 5 months old or something. You get these little tiny shoes, you know. So the mother sees that shoes, and a tear comes to the eye, you know. What is she, crying about a little piece of leather or something, or whatever it may be? No, she's thinking of the child. This is the child's shoe. She sees the baby. She remembers how he walked in that, and that's, you know, now he's growing up. Da 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 da. You know, goes to kindergarten. You see, so the material thing reminds the mother of the child, and there's a relationship there. So there's a whole bunch of emotions that grow up. So similarly, the realized soul sees this whole world related to the beloved Krishna. It's not, you see, it's not just some mental construct, but there's a relationship there. And so everything and everyone, this is why great devotees like Srila Prabhupada were mad practically to preach. Because here's all these, you know, billions of human beings. You know, you can't preach to the dogs and cats, but the billions of human beings who, at least theoretically, can understand this. You know, if they have some kind of intelligence, they can understand and start their path out of this prison house of the material world where there's so much suffering. You see how knowledge is so important, and the vision to have that and to feel the compassion, because you yourself are experiencing the relationship with Krishna, the nectar of the relationship, and the like we were saying yesterday, or that was it yesterday? I'm sorry, I was in LA and gave a class. I think it was the last class I gave here. The different qualities of the Mahabhagavat. You remember that he's tied with a rope. Didn't I mention that? The lotus feet of the Lord into his heart. Yeah, I think I mentioned that. Yeah. So you know, there's a different kind of awareness. So the realized soul is constantly drinking in that, you know, presence of Krishna, because Krishna is reciprocating so nicely, so warmly and completely, that he wants to give that to others. Because everybody has a right to it. Everybody can experience it. There's no material bar from that. Doesn't matter what race you are, what language you are, what age you are, what gender you are. That's just external. So you can see the urgency there. So he doesn't see anything separate from me, for his realized knowledge of me has destroyed such illusory perception. You see, that's a high state of consciousness. Sava-bhūndani makpaśe bhagavad-bhāvam-ātmanaha bhagavad-ātmani... I always forget the rest. I don't know if you can remember. But this is the verse describing the Uttama Bhakta, or Uttama Adhikari. Sava Bhuteshu Yakpashed. He sees me and everyone and everything in me. You know. So that's a vision, a kind of vision that we should strive for. But there's a certain residue, if you will, because you're still in the material body. So there has to be, distinctions have to be made. Since the material body and mind were previously accustomed to this kind of perception, it may sometimes appear to reoccur or recur. In other words, seeing things separate from me, making distinctions. But at the time of death, the self-realized soul achieves opulence equal to mine. So this kind of understanding, and you can see, you know, Prabhupada made distinctions. What's heat and cold. You know, he told the disciples, whatever you do, don't let me get cold, because he knew that he would get ill, his health was weak, you know. So heat and cold has to be understood, you see what I mean? At the same time, this may refer to someone who is, you know, I mean, Prabhupada was seeing that, but he was seeing it in terms of how it will affect his service to Krishna. But the point of this verse is that there may, you know, enter into the mind some of these distinctions. But at the time of death, when everything is very intensified, and you know you're no longer concerned with these dualities, then such a great soul still goes back to Godhead. And this thing of getting the opulence is equal to Krishna. This is an interesting point. Now, we don't serve Krishna and practice devotional service to attain some opulence, right? I mean, are we thinking, oh, I'm one of these days I'm going to get all the wealth? You know, Krishna has all the wealth, right? Or at least a good part of it, you know. We're not thinking like that. That's not the motive of the devotee. And yet, Krishna, the idea is that Krishna shares the opulences with his devotee. Just like the beauty, you know, in the spiritual world, these devotees, like, you know, Radharani, because she's a special, she's internal energy, but just regular devotees, they're extraordinarily beautiful and attractive. You know, there's no material inebriety or covers, you know. Because Krishna likes that, and he's sharing his infinite beauty with the devotees, you know. And he's in the opulence. There's a nice verse. Let's see if I can remember this verse. There was once a discussion. I think it was an argument, you know, friendly argument, transcendental, between who was it, Srivas Thakur and Srup Damodar? I think so. And they were arguing which is the most opulent. Is it Vaikuntha? Or is it Vrindavan? So, the one who was arguing for Vaikuntha, I think they were just playing it, said, look, in Vrindavan, there's just, you know, trees and some leaves and there's water, you know, and it's an ordinary coward village. But in Vaikuntha, or in Dwarka, there's palaces with lapis lazuli and ivory and, you know, all of the, you know, the beds are made of as soft and white as the foam of milk, you know, and all of these incredible things. So how can you say Vrindavan is more opulent than Vaikuntha? So then there's a verse quoted from Bilva Mangal Thakur. It's not in the Krishna Karnamrita. Vrindavanam vajananam nanukama denu vindani cheti sukasinda dahova bhuti chintamani chatanabhushana manganam shringara pushpatadavak sadavaksodanam Vrindavanam vrtananam nanukama denu vrindani cheti sukasindoraho vibhuti. So where the word vibhuti means opulence. Chapter 10 of the 10th canto of the Bhagavad Gita, what's it called? Vibhuti Yoga. Vibhuti. So this is Krishna speaks about his own opulences. I am the ocean of bodies of water. Right? So he's speaking of his own vibhutis. So here the verse is very nice. It says, Chintamani Charanabhushana Manganana, that the gopis, they have these ankle bells. Charanabhushanam means the ornament for the feet, right? So you say, well, okay, they have these ornaments for the feet, but in Vrindavan, you know, in Dwarka, the queens have unlimited, you know, diamonds and Marakata jewels and all these things. So what's the comparison? The gopis are wearing their little ankle bells. But wait. These ankle bells are made of chintamani. Chintamani chatanbhuanganam. And the trees, they may look like ordinary trees, but they're called bhriksha trees. You can get any amount of fruit in any season, completely ripe, or anything else from these bhriksha trees. They may look, you see, it's covered. In other words, the opulence is hidden in such sort of way so that the sweetness comes out in Goloka. So the trees may look ordinary, but they're not, you know. But the real opulence, you know, above all of these in Vrindavan, that's not there in Dwarka, or Vaikuntha, are the cows. Vrindavanam vajananam dana. Dana means wealth. Vrindavanam vajananam nanu, certainly kamadenu vrindani, or the herds of kamadenus, you know, these cows that give abundant milk and also they give anything else. Sukasindu aho vibhuti. So that makes Vrindavan the ocean of happiness. Sukasindur. Aho, just see how wonderful the opulence, vibhuti of Vrindavan. So the idea is that, and these opulences are all shared. Krishna shares these opulences. If you are able to enter into Goloka Vrindavan, you're smelling the same flowers that Krishna is, you know. You're experiencing the same Surabhi cows. You're enjoying through Krishna the same relationship with, you know, that he has with all his devotees. So Krishna loves to share. He loves to share his opulences with his loving devotees. So in this sense, he achieves the opulences equal to mine. And in the Kapila Dev section, the third canto, he says, and these are never lost. Unlike anything we get in this material world, which is ultimately lost because we leave the body. If not before, you lose it. But there, you never lose those opulences. Just like you never have to leave there, you never lose the opulences. So that's the place that we want to go to. Let's see if I go through some of these points in the purport. Okay, so you have to keep the body and mind fit. So we eat sufficient food, sufficient rest, and we stay warm, we have clothes. And so therefore, those kind of things we have to maintain in the material world to keep our service. That's clear. Okay. Now, this is an interesting statement worth remembering. The function of illusion is to separate one from Lord Krishna. And we have been separated in that sense from Lord Krishna since time immemorial. We've been embracing illusion. You know, we've been listening to the illusory energy to enjoy. Come enjoy me. Come enjoy me. And every time we get cheated. But then, it's remaining in illusion, we think the next time we'll become happy here. In this next, even in this one life, people make so many plans. You know, and when they're thwarted, they make new plans to try to enjoy it, a ward off. So that illusory embrace has to be given up. So that's the function of illusion. But that illusionary energy, Maya Devi, is also an expansion of Yoga Maya. It's one personality. So when we turn back to Krishna, this very same energy can act in such a way to bring us closer to Krishna. What is this book? This is nothing but ordinary paper, right? That these words are printed on. There's millions and billions of books out there that have nothing to do with Krishna. But the same energy of paper and ink, right? And believe me, the lot of work that goes into making the book, you know, all the computers and everything, that's part of the material energy, but it's bringing us closer to Krishna. So the art of devotional service is employing whatever we can from the material side in Krishna's service, spiritualizing it in that way and making it into an agent for us to connect to Krishna. That's real yoga. That's called the art of work in Bhagavad Gita. How to work in such a way in this world that you don't get attached, you don't incur any karma because you're not doing anything selfishly or fruitively, but you're still using the elements of this world, like we're using so many things here, to bring us closer to Krishna. This building, these flowers, these sounds, right? This water, everything that we're using, the Bhumir Apar Olamo Vayu, right? I don't know if you realize it, but these artik, we're offering the earth, the water, the fire, right? The fragrance, the smell, you know, the sound, the ether, the sound is going. These are all the elements, those eight elements. And the mind has to be there. Sometimes we forget to offer our mind. The mind is wandering. The more that your mind and intelligence is focused on what you're doing, the more benefit you get from your devotions. So, but we're offering the Krishna, connecting, you see, to him or to the spiritual master, worshipable personality. And in this way they all become purified. And that's why we take the remnants, take the heat, the water comes, the flower comes, you see, prasadam comes. Because it's now spiritual, it connects us to Krishna. So it's all very scientific. This has been worked out by our acharyas. You know, Narada Muni, he created the Narada Pancharatra, you know, with the details of deity worship. And Sanatana Goswami wrote the Hari Bhakti Vilas under the instruction of Lord Chaitanya, how to be a householder and be Krishna conscious. The different elements, it's worth, we need to study this. You know, Prabhupada gleaned the essence of it and gave it to us in Nectar Devotion. It's all been chalked out. The path has been chalked out. But you can see how, you know, the whole idea is to turn our attention, we as marginal energy, to turn our attention again toward Krishna and come under the influence of that internal energy so that we can hang on to Krishna's lotus feet and get out of this material world, go back to Godhead. So let's see what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says in the latter portion. Okay, so basic, I covered that. Yeah, this point is probably to make. You know, depending on the mode you're in, you'll see the world that way. Atmavan manyate jagat. It's a nice phrase. You learn these little phrases. Atmavan mean as you are, you think the world is. Right? You think the world is like that. So a very lusty person who's walking down Garnet Avenue, you know, he doesn't see the old women and the old men, you know, the previous second. But then when he's, you know, you see an attractive young woman, then you focus on that. Everything is seen in terms of what can satisfy your lust, you know. Or someone who's very entrepreneurial or greedy, you know. Where is there some business to do around here? How can I, you know, make a buck, you know? You go walk down Garnet, what's for sale? What business is, you know, vacant? How I can make this, you know. You're looking in that terms. You see according to your central mentality, or as you are, you know. If you're a cheater and a scoundrel, you'll tend to say, oh, everybody's like that. Yeah. You know, that's why the gossip pages are so popular, because they tend to, you know, bring everyone down, and then you can feel better about yourself. You know, oh, everyone's doing it. I don't have to feel guilty. So you, as you are, so you'll see everything. So if you're thinking of Krishna, you see everything as his energy. So you see Krishna everywhere. You can see Krishna everywhere. That's the whole idea of this passage in Bhagavatam. Okay. So that's basically import here. Is there any discussion or questions on these points? I'll read the verse again. That may stimulate some.
So there's no cows in Vaikuntha?
No cows in Vaikuntha?
When you're giving that story and you said the opulence of Vrindavan is the cows. So I'm just kind of wondering.
I don't think they're in Vaikuntha, but they're there in Dwarka, in the Dwarka part of Goloka, because Krishna's always giving cows in charity, right? From his palaces. 13,000 a day out of each palace or something. But in Vaikuntha, I haven't heard. I have to read the Beer Bhagavatamrita again. I think there's a detailed description of Vaikuntha. They're not there in the same way that they are in Vrindavan. Certainly the Lord is not going out to herd them. You know, that's the thing. That's the real nectar part. He goes to herd the cows. Okay, I'll go. Another one, go ahead.
I just have a general philosophical question. I was having a discussion yesterday with a devotee, and he was making the point that there's no degrees of false ego. You're either under the false ego or you're not. And I was making the point that, of course, there's degrees. You know, the person that's been chanting for 50 years is going to be less influenced by the false ego than someone who's a neophyte. That was the point I was making. So I was just wondering what you would say on that.
Well, you know, consciousness is a very complex thing. The mind is many, many faceted. And I would say, you know, false ego, we have an ego, right? We have a sense of self. Everyone has. When you're acting, when you're forgetting Krishna, then, you know, somehow or other, you're acting under false ego, because you have to have an identity. Our real identity is you know, a part and parcel of Krishna, to always remember Krishna. So if we forget that, then it's false, right? We're having, so at that moment or in that period of time, you're acting under what we call the false ego, the false sense of self. If you again remember Krishna and you serve Krishna, then you're in real ego. So it definitely flips back and forth. Now, you're right, you can be, you know, somewhat Krishna conscious, right? We're Krishna conscious. Just like in our rounds, we're somewhat Krishna conscious, but sometimes the mind is wandering a million miles away. You bring it back, you know. So essentially, you know, it's not all or nothing. You could say, you could term it as a degree of false ego, a kind of a spectrum. But there is something to be said for the idea that, well, depending on how you're thinking and acting, you're either in false ego or you're in real ego. But the way we really experience it is that one from moment to moment, you know, we're Krishna conscious, somewhat Krishna conscious. Oh, you know, bringing back the mind under the control of the self, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. So I think that, you know, both terminologies can be used, and it's just a different perspective. Those who are, you know, completely forgetful of Krishna, they're firmly under the grip of the false ego, and it can go on for millions and millions of births, and it does. And, you know, only in the human life really can you start acting in your real ego. So in this material world, the false ego is very, very powerful and very predominant. But a few fortunate souls can begin to discover their real self, their real ego, who they really are, and act in that way, and ultimately come to the point of simply being situated in their real self or real ego, you know, instead of the false ego. I think that's about the best I can do with it. Yes, Abhin.
This is speculative, but I was thinking, you were talking about the five elements and then the three subtle elements. Eight elements. Tell me how true this is. The mind, intellect, and false ego, could that make up the astral and the causal body? And then when we leave the body? And then.
Totally.
And then the five elements become memory, so it's like subtle.
No, the idea is that. In one place it's said that, you know, that the objects of the senses enter into the mind, and the mind enters into them, you know. So when it's described right in the 15th chapter, and I'll tell you, there's a passage in the 4th canto that even goes into greater detail, and also Vasudeva's Gita, in his attempt to save Devaki when he's talking about reincarnation, you know, he's trying to convince Kamsa not to kill Devaki, and he goes into this really nice, you know, description of reincarnation. Prabhupada gives these wonderful purports. So the idea is that, you know, we have the two bodies, you know, probably the shirt and coat, you know, the shirt and coat, or I have this you know. So I got the kurta, and I've got this, you know, new sweatshirt. And then there's me, there's the body. So in this analogy, the body itself, the raw body, you know, naked body, is the soul. The kurta is the subtle body. And the coat is the external body, what we call the gross body. So, you know, I may take this off 10 times a day, but I'll keep my kurta on. So when I take the sweatshirt off, that's like death, right? I'm leaving the body, but I still have my kurta on. And if I want to go back to God, then I have to come naked before God, or something. You know, I mean, I have to actually take the kurta off, and then the soul will be there. So similarly, we go from body to body, but we retain the subtle body. The gross body is temporary clothes, vasangsi jirnani yatavihai, right? Second chapter. But the subtle body stays with us, and all of the activities and impressions and desires and fears and everything that we experience in this lifetime, plus others from previous lifetimes, are still impinging on us. You know, they're there in the mind, so, you know, subconscious. Prabhupada doesn't use that word, but he talks about that, the stock, you know. So that, you know, forms like a template for the next gross body. And we have memories, you're right, of experiences of these gross things, of these impressions, this sense gratification, that sense gratification, whatever it is. So that's how the transmigration is going on and on. And when to become perfected in self-realization or God consciousness means to also give up the subtle body. You know, to leave that and be situated in your spiritual body, which also has an element of hands and senses and mind, intelligence, and intellect, and ego, but it's purely made of spirit. We have these things in spirit, but it's been covered. Hare Krishna. They're covered by the gross and subtle material elements, yeah.
I was under the impression that the subtle body was outside of the physical body, like an aura, instead of inside of it. It's like that outer subtle shell around the physical body.
So that I don't remember reading. It's hard to place it. You know, don't point your feet, I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, where it is. Sometimes it's said that the mind and the heart, you know, the mind is really in the heart, you know, area. You know, we think it's in the brain because the brain is kind of like the computer by which you, the mind can interact with the externals through the brain and the nervous system. You see, but to think that the mind is located in the brain, I think, is a mistake according to our theology. Listen, we need to continue this over breakfast. It's getting late. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.